Welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we engage in lively and thoughtful conversations with professionals in the nonprofit world. My name is Margaret Katz-Kann, and I'm here today with my teammate, Michelle Malloy-Dillon.
Thanks, Margaret. And we're here with Lisa Halley. And Lisa is a coach, and she has a deep philanthropy background. She's also got a background in law. And she's served in leadership positions in law, healthcare, higher education, and philanthropy. She has such an interesting history of work and what she has done in the world. And she has shared a fantastic blog with us. Welcome, Lisa.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So you share in your blog this fascinating story of this really difficult time in your career. Yeah. During this capital fundraising campaign and what you learned along the way. Tell us just a little bit about that story.
Sure. So I had been working in higher education in Central Maine at Colby College, which is where I went to school, which is in Waterville, which is my hometown. And the local hospital system, which owned several old hospitals, two primary ones, one in Augusta and one in Waterville, 20 miles apart, both built in the 50s, and they needed to be, they were very outdated. I mean, it was to the point where you couldn't even install modern equipment because the facilities were just too old and too small. Very hard to recruit doctors to a rural area. And so they needed a new hospital. And so they decided to build a regional hospital. And I thought to myself, this is an opportunity to do something that is going to really matter to the people from my hometown. We'll see the benefit for generations. And I just thought, I have to be a part of this. So I decided to join the team, and I got the job, and I got in there. And on day one, I looked at the records of their previous campaign and said, holy cow. First of all, this is a massively expensive project, and I have no idea how we're going to do this. Central Maine is not known for its wealth. So how do you engage donors at the level that you're going to need to? So it was just daunting, exciting, incredibly important challenge. And I thought, I got to do this. And my mantra became at the outset, failure is not an option. So it was all about setting really big goals that scared everybody, including the CEO, a little bit. And putting out numbers that were daunting, you know, how are we going to get this done? And so it starts out, and like most campaigns, you know, there was obviously a reason why you're doing this. It's very important, and getting the community engaged in it. I had a very mixed bag, one town that was very excited about it and the other town that was very not excited about it. Not surprisingly, the town getting the new regional hospital was very excited. The more northern town perceived itself as losing. So it was a very unbalanced whatever effort. But as we all know in fundraising, the number one thing to do is to gather excitement around the opportunity and to build momentum. So coming from that place of how do we generate excitement and build momentum, we just got to it and we got some exciting. Our lead gift, of course, was the first thing out of the gate, and it was a matching grant. It was a very large grant that had a matching component to it. The first, you know, so the matching component had to be substantial, but not so substantial we couldn't do it. So I had to look at what had been done in the past and come up with a more aggressive goal, but something I thought was achievable. So that's what we did. And you know, I think that the biggest learning I had, and as many learnings, and I put a few of them in the blog, but one of the learnings I learned is, you know, campaigns are marathons. Mm-hmm. And the hardest thing about being in a campaign that goes over a long period of time is sustaining momentum. It's one thing to build it in the outset with a large leadership gift and the excitement generated around that and putting out pretty pictures of what the hospital is going to look like. But you know, this campaign from start to finish, I was there for 5 years. So the whole process of planning and then starting to launch into the quiet phase and then launching the public phase and closing it out and actually opening the hospital took about 5 years. And it was far from a smooth journey. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. I feel like I'm going off in the left field.
Lisa, I'd love to. Both Michelle and I were involved with an organization in Boulder, the Community Foundation here, and the founding executive director used to say, "We look like swans to those of us who see us from the outside, but what they don't see is that underneath the water, we are paddling so hard."
So my metaphor was sausage making. You don't ever want to see how the sausage is made.
So, you know, we all hear ultimately about the success of capital campaigns, but in your blog, you shared, you know, the personal impact that this had. And to me, that was, it was so authentic and profound. Can you share a little bit about the toll that that took on you?
Yeah. Things went along well. They went along very well for the first year or so as I was getting my feet under me. But as you get into the year two, you're moving on, you inevitably hit lulls, as we all know, and moments when it is a little quiet and you really got to start like, how do I generate this? And it really felt like I had to generate it. That's how I interpreted it. Like it had to come from me. What big idea can I come up with next? So I found myself unable to turn off my brain at the end of the day. It was just like, oh my goodness. It felt a little overwhelming to me.
You mentioned like you had the failure is not an option, like motto in your head. Like I can hear that was like, no, I can't. I must keep going.
Yeah. It's the failure is not an option coupled with the it's all on me.
Yeah.
It's so misleading and untrue because I had a team of fabulous people, but you know, my direct reports, you know, you're managing people. So you're also managing people to achieve the goal. It felt a little bit like the buck was stopping with me. It felt a lot like that to me. Mm-hmm. The reality, you know, was there were a lot of other people who cared too, but it very much felt like I owned this. So I started not really being able to sleep, and that's you couldn't turn my brain off, really difficult. And I did turn to, you know, sleep aids, and Ambien is a very hard habit to break. If anybody tells you it's non-habit forming, that's misleading. It took a long time to get off of Ambien. It was a habit, the unfortunate bad habit, a crutch. I felt I couldn't get, and it's psychological. I felt I couldn't get to sleep without something after a while. And then you start just, working all the time, just, you know, feeling like if there were a spare hour, I really ought to be doing something. What can I do? You know, and just not giving myself much latitude and definitely not creating safe boundaries around personal time, protecting personal time. And at the time we were building the hospital, I had aging parents in Florida. My dad had to have some significant heart surgery. I had to go down there to help take care of him. Eventually we moved them back to Maine. I had to find a place for them to live. The whole parent caretaking thing happening at the same time as the campaign, as everyone has issues in their personal life.
Yeah. I hear it's like this multiple like things began to just build on you. And I don't know about Margaret, but I hear a lot about this with my coaching clients too. Sure. You know, as we record this, it's like fall of, 2021, and, COVID is here, but not here. It's like this strange, weird, and people have been navigating so many different things. Yeah. And there are a lot of people who have been working from home and haven't been creating those boundaries like they used to when they went to the office and shutting things down.
Right. And I'm actually serve on the board of the Maine Association of Nonprofits. So I'm in this sort of looking at the infrastructure of how we support our nonprofit partners and seeing the emergence from COVID and how people are taking a different view of life and work. I think people are a little bit more careful about protecting time. We had a moment when we're home a lot. We got to spend more time with our families. And some of us really like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's made people a little bit more aware. But, you know, one thing about campaigns and building momentum, and specifically to the world of capital campaigns, fundraising is a what have you done for me lately kind of business. You can have a wonderful gift come in one week, and the next week people are saying to you, okay, TikTok. So it's relentless. And so I think the important part, I was thinking about a metaphor for this and I came up with one. It's not perfect by any means, but you know how when you're learning to bowl and they put up those safety rail, the gutter rails to keep you like in your lane. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost a little bit like putting up bumper zones to protect you. That is really what I didn't do that mm-hmm. I wish I had done, is just forcing myself to just break away and do something for me. And that could look like working out, which is how I used to cope in my prior days when I wasn't in charge of campaigns. I was just a player. I could more easily break away and have that self-care moment and maintain my health. But when I switched to being the leader, I just felt that pressure. There wasn't that opportunity. And also I didn't realize in healthcare, there are lots of meetings and you're expected to be at all of them and get all your work done. So the day gets chewed up and your schedule becomes not your own, which I think happens in a lot of large organizations.
So I'm hearing of that, it's like, you know, what's the story you were telling yourself that now that I'm the leader, this is what I need to do versus, you know, now exactly. Your future self, you're standing here looking back at that. Yep. What's the story you wish you had told yourself in that moment?
I wish I told myself that what I was trying to do was time limited and I needed to protect more time for myself, honestly, to maybe bow out of a few of these large meetings and just refocus my attention on getting more done with less. And I think also there's an underlying principle of non-attachment that I've learned since being, and if you're familiar with it, but I'll explain it briefly. It's basically, you know, and a lot of this I learned in yoga. It comes from, Bhagavad Gita, which I cannot say, is the idea that you commit yourself fully with your effort without attachment to the result. And it relieves the pressure of I'm responsible for everything, because everyone who's ever done a fundraising campaign knows there are as many surprises in a campaign as there are intentional asks that result in gifts. I mean, thank God, things come out of the woodwork sometimes and you get really lucky.
What I hear in that too, it's like, enjoy the journey. Like it's not all about just the end goal.
Yeah.
But
And campaigns are, you know, campaigns are about numbers. So it's so easy to get caught up in that number and forget about the people. And, you know, every gift is a human being and they're incredibly magnificent people who that would move me greatly. When the mail would come in and we would get a gift of, you know, $50 from someone on very limited means, you know, get these handwritten letters from, you know, people of older people and kids going out there and doing fundraisers, and like, it's the community. That's the stuff. And just savoring in that, you know, taking the time to be with those people and just enjoy those moments and not be thinking about, you know, well, where's the next one going to come from? You know,
where's tomorrow's mail? I'm sort of curious. I mean, I think, you know, that what you're talking about and the story that you've shared is, it's probably almost epidemic in the fundraising world. You know, there's so much burnout and so I'm just sort of curious, like, what is it maybe? And it sounds like you've made a lot of changes and done huge learning based on pain, but that you've gotten there. But for people who are in fundraising, like, what do you think it is about our personalities or our narratives, you know, that make it so hard to draw these kind of boundaries?
Well, I know for me, I'm a purpose-driven person. Like I love getting big things done. As a volunteer in my hometown, I joined the Opera House board, and built in 1903. And we did a renovation, had to be done if we were going to lose this magnificent theater. And I just said to everybody, this can't happen on our watch. That again, you know, I love to pick things out of the air that other people aren't thinking about and say, let's get this done. and then get it done. So goal, being goal oriented is huge plus in so many ways, but it's got a dark side to it. And that's the, you know, losing sight of everything else in focusing on that goal, losing sight of the forest for the trees a little bit. Maybe that's not the right metaphor.
Well, that, you know, you're hitting so much on my, sorry, my voice is cracking. You're hitting so much on the reason why I love working with people who are in nonprofits so much. It's like, you know, the heart is in the right place. You know, it's like wanting to help, exactly. Wanting to save something that's of value.
Yeah. If we didn't, my rule for when I left law, I literally left law to become a fundraiser for an organization that I cared deeply about called City Year, which is now part of the AmeriCorps program. The AmeriCorps program didn't exist. City Year was an inspiration to Bill Clinton to create it. And after he did, I thought, this is my Peace Corps moment. It's like a new entity being born, and I can come and help make AmeriCorps part of the American fabric. And I couldn't turn that down. That purpose is a purpose bigger than myself. That's going to leave the world better off than I found it. That's what made me leave law and go into philanthropy. So given that, that ambition is huge and has no boundaries. And so coming from my heart, and I have a huge heart, I'll do anything. Because I am not the important piece of this. What I'm doing is the important piece of this. And what I learned by this very negative experience is that I actually am really important, that without my health, I can't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's like, hello. And I mentioned my parents for a very specific reason. I was watching particularly my mom grow old, and she was in her 80s. She died 2 years after I left the hospital. And I was watching her, let's just say, reap the harvest of her health choices over the years. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, you know, she's my mom. Like there is the future me, if I choose to be that. You know, she had osteoporosis, and all the things that can go with brittle bones, and ultimately that is what contributed to her death. And so it's a big wake up call in that sense too. You're going like these habits. So when the doctor came back and kind of gave me the warning, I thought, what am I doing? I am sowing the seeds in my 50s of what my life in my 80s, if I'm so lucky to live that long, are going to look like. Like what kind of a 70-year-old or 80-year-old do I want to be?
Yeah. And what you're pointing to also is like, how do we want our life to feel and be, yeah, even in the midst of busy, yeah, and creating amazing change and reaching goals and all of these wonderful things?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's
exactly
such an interesting, you know, we all talk about or think about, like, you know, oh, people say on their deathbed, they never look back and wish that they had worked more. They only wish they had, exactly, spent more time with their families. But there's part of what I'm hearing from you, Lisa, like this incredible alignment to legacy and purpose, like that actually there may be some different calculus that gets to happen, you know, as you look back. And that's a really, it's a tricky margin to dance around.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. It's balancing self with larger purpose, I think, in some respects. You know, as I said in the piece, sort of flippantly, like, you know, I discovered I am people too. You know, like, you know, I want to make the world a better place for everyone. Well, you know, that includes me. And I think in some ways that's the hardest lesson, because no one's going to stop and point that out to you, except maybe your doctor. you know, that, you know, Lisa, this isn't really a very good way to live. And, you know, you're really having some serious impacts on your health with this lifestyle. You need to pay more attention. When you get that, I think if anyone ever gets that road sign, it's like, hello, pay attention, because that's not the norm. And, you know, that's not how we if someone takes the time to point out to you that you look like you're really stressed, you probably are really stressed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You probably need to take a break.
So what's one of the things that began to sort of turn the ship for you toward a healthier way of being? And
yeah, so I had the great good fortune of getting to know a donor, incredibly generous family, who served on our, he served on our board. And he also was a fan of a place called Kripalu, which is in Western Massachusetts, a yoga and retreat center. And he wanted to create some healthy living programs at our hospital that looked a lot like what Kripalu offered. So he said, gee, I'd like you to go out there and check it out, which is not a hard gig. So I went out with my colleague, one of the senior physicians, and she and I went to a food and medicine institute, which I think was old hat for her because she's a doctor and a very good one. But for me, it was truly eye-opening to understand the connection between what we eat and how we age and how we thrive or not, and all the roles that, you know, these various, we don't think about what we eat, you know, sometimes. I certainly wasn't as mindful. I learned a lot, and I put those things into practice slowly. I started to practice yoga. I started to do some limited meditation, and I started to change my diet, and I found a naturopathic physician to help me really drill down on nutrition. She prescribed an anti-inflammatory diet because one of the things that happens when you're stressed constantly is your body's producing cortisol. I learned about that, and cortisol is your inflammation is a big causing factor as well. So working with her, just implementing a pretty simple diet, it just didn't involve a lot of food choices, but it was effective and it really reduced the inflammation. I mean, that was I did lose weight, which was great, but it was about the inflammation. And then over time, some of these habits I learned while working with her, I still to this day maintain. I can't say COVID was good for the weight, but that
for
had
any
to
of
do,
us
or for anyone, but it had to do much more with inactivity than anything, just being not going out as much. I mean, not
a lot of time exercising. In our kitchens. Yeah.
A lot of time in the kitchen, not so much in the gym.
Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of thing. But at the time that was the moment was that wake up call I talk about in the post about, you know, that, you know, really just being perpetually sick once my immune system broke down. And then, you know, the other piece, which I didn't put in there because quite frankly, it's embarrassing, is that my A1C index was really high. That was frightening. I was diagnosed as pre-diabetic. Mm-hmm. And that's a jolt. Like, holy crap, do I not want to be a diabetic?
Yeah.
And very motivating.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Lisa, you talk about all these different ways that you came at it, you know, diet, meditation, yoga. How did you get them to stick? Like, you know, it is so many of us. I mean, I hear my own brain saying, oh, I want to do more of that too, you know? And it's something I might do for a couple of days and then I don't do it anymore. Like, how did you make it stick for you?
You know, I can't say with all honesty, I kept it sticking as much as I needed to during the campaign. I would do things like instill habits of taking 5 minutes before going into a meeting. The key was planning in buffer time, mm-hmm. so that I had enough time to travel. Meetings were notorious for ending on the hour and starting on the next hour with no transition time, which made everybody late for the next meeting. So we talked about adding in habit changing about meetings, to have meetings end at quarter of, to give people time to get to the next meeting, starting building in time to drive between meetings so that I wouldn't be constantly like trying to break speed limit laws, getting from one meeting to another, because we were all over the place physically and there was no Zoom.
Well, and even now in Zoom, it's like, you know, planning a buffer time between Zoom meetings is important because
everybody needs a pee break from time to time.
Right.
And I underestimated the importance of that. I think everybody does. We all think, you know, efficient. There is a tension between efficiency and health There just is this quote efficiency. I want to say quote efficiency because I actually don't think it's efficient for us to do back to back to back to back meetings. People don't hear people.
Well,
don't.
And what's the efficient thing in the long run? The efficient thing in the long run is to take care of ourselves. And so we don't fall apart and have a complete breakdown.
Right? So that's so, so if I were to say there's an overarching theme to this, it's short-term thinking. Because it's always the urgent, you know, Stephen Covey does a great job with this, right? The urgent, but not important.
Right.
It's urgent because the phone is ringing, but it really isn't that important. Like making a sort of a, it's a little self-protection, maybe shut your phone off, maybe just let it go to voicemail for a half an hour or have your assistant say, you know, she's just unavailable right now. You know, if it's the CEO, put him through. If it's the chair of the campaign, put him through. Other than that, you know, that kind of thing, but learning to protect yourself. I had a fabulous assistant who literally would get on the computer and tell me how long it takes to get from point A to point B and remind me to leave at X time so that I could have enough time to get to Y place. Can't say enough about her.
And you bring up a good point with that too, because there's an aspect to asking for help or looking in, you know, around you. And because you mentioned earlier, like it, you felt very alone, like the buck stopped with you.
Yeah.
And so often we feel that way. And it's like, well, what kind of help can I get? Well, having your assistant give you, you know, that kind of thing is really helpful. Or there might be some other kind of help that you can get. So it's not all on your shoulders.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's asking for help can be so challenging, especially for people who have this, like, failure is not an option. Like
failure is not an option.
You know, I've got to meet the goal. Yes. Lisa, I am the leader. Like, I have to know what I'm doing. I have to get there all by myself and know every answer on the way.
Yeah.
Lisa, you've given us so many things that have been helpful for you. But if you had to leave our listeners with just one tool or challenge or idea, what would you like to offer?
I think the most helpful thing I did was to introduce the short meditation daily to start my day. It was issued to me as a challenge to do it for 30 days because it takes 30 days to build a habit. And if you can do it for 30 days, you really will build a muscle. And it's so simple to do. You know, you have a phone. I know you do. You take your timer out. You put it on an amount of time. It could be 5 minutes. I did 10 because I just 10 just felt right. And then every day when you've done it, you take one of those little, go buy yourself some of those little stickers. And I bought little stars or whatever fun thing you want. And you put it on your calendar after you've done it, like on your paper calendar on your wall, which if you have it, and then it tracks every day you've done it. You feel like, wow, I did that today. I did that for myself today. And then you do it every morning and it really changes your whole approach to the day. It helps to ground you so that when you come into your busy day, you just feel like you're breathing better.
Yeah. What I love about the sticker chart is it reminds me of the potty chart I did with both my kids to teach them potty training. I did the exact same thing. I put a sticker every time they peed on the day. And if they got so many stickers, you know, but we need to reward ourselves with something like I can see it. Like it's really helpful to do that.
It's so
concrete.
There's
a wonderful free app out there too called the Insight Timer app.
Yeah.
Which is a great meditation.
I love Insight Timer. Love Insight Timer. I also do subscribe to Calm.
Oh yeah.
Which I really love too. Meditation apps that just do it. She does a daily 10-minute guided meditation, which is a great way to start if you've never meditated and you just blank space just intimidates you. It's a way to walk you into it. So highly recommend both of those tools.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, and we have a free resource at Fundraising Leadership that we'd like to share with our listeners too. It's a 7-day coaching challenge where you can sign up for a free resource on our free resource page of our fundraisingleadership.org website and get a little challenge to be more coach-like in your management and leadership style. And this will give your direct reports more of an aspect of allowing them to be them, learning how to ask for help. Some of the themes that we have talked about in the conversation today too. Yeah. So thank you, Lisa.
Yeah, no. I want to especially say thank you for just really authentically sharing your story, which I think, you know, you've named something that's hard for people to talk about, but really is very, very common.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
This podcast is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership. We provide unique coaching and training programs that powerfully transform how you work in order to get results. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are enjoying the show, you can help us continue to bring thoughtful content with a monthly or annual contribution. This supports our production costs and keeps the show ad-free. Make a contribution today using the link in the show notes. Now go put it into practice.